Welcome to Jen Squeezes Hard Truths. We bring you the untold stories about why basic life milestones, like owning a home, raising a family, and living on a habitable planet, are slipping out of reach for younger Canadians. And how we can make this country work more fairly for all generations. I'm Angie Chan.
I'm Megan Wild.
And I'm Paul Kershaw.
Guys, the gang's back together!
Woo!
There has been a bit of a delay, it's true, but we are really kicking into high gear now.
This season, we're trying something new. We are going to bring some new voices into our conversations about generational fairness. This time around, we have Megan and Paul leading the interview, and I am in the lucky position of getting to listen in on the interview, and I will come back in at the end and reflect on some of the big themes that came out. I can't wait. Today, Amber Bennett joins us from Calgary. Amber is the Deputy Director of ReClimate, a new center for climate change communication at Carleton University. Previously, she led the Alberta Narratives Project, which created a guide to talking about climate and energy in constructive ways. This massive, groundbreaking engagement project held 50 province-wide discussions with nearly 500 people from a wide range of groups, farmers, oil sand workers, energy leaders, business leaders, youth, environmentalists, new Canadians, and more.
That's why we've invited Amber to discuss today's hard truth. It can be frickin' hard to talk openly and productively about complex, controversial problems, especially with someone we don't agree with, whether it's about climate or generational unfairness. At the same time, talking about these problems builds understanding and solidarity. So these discussions are actually a really important climate action that people can take in their everyday lives. Amber's here to equip us all with some expert guidance about crossing conversational divides to find hope and common ground. Hello, Amber.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we're working now on our first ever voter's guide for Alberta. We've already found the province's leaders are having a very different conversation on a lot of our issues than we've seen when we were working on voters' guides for Ontario and BC. So to start out with, could you give us a sense of how does the public understanding and dialogue about climate in particular differ in Alberta from the rest of the country?
Yeah, well, despite what the rest of Canada might think, and probably even what Albertans think, we're not that different than the rest of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in terms of overall belief, 9 out of 10 Albertans, 9 out of 10 Canadians would say climate's happening. Just under half would question the degree to which human activity plays a role in climate change. Also very similar to the rest of Canada. And also what tracks very similar to the rest of Canada are support for less oil and gas production or development, more oil and gas production and development, or stay the same. And so in the rest of Canada and in Alberta, you basically see a third, a third, a third. So we're as divided on kind of similar questions that you see in the same way as you might see in other parts of Canada. We do have a little lower levels of literacy. So like, what are the causes? You know, what are the policy solutions? But to be honest, the rest of Canada's pretty subpar as well. The big differences, if you're interested, in Alberta to the rest of Canada would be this kind of tension that you see around people's values around protecting the environment versus protecting the economy. And in Alberta, the economy and the energy sector, or oil and gas or fossil fuel production, is so closely tied together. So the big difference here is that people feel that there's a choice between protecting the environment or protecting the oil and gas industry for, you know, more or less. And so that doesn't really exist in other places. And I think the other piece that would be a little bit different here is the timeline for transition. So this is less coming from surveys, more from focus groups with mostly people in the middle of the political spectrum. And when we talked about transition, most people would say it's inevitable, very similar to the rest of Canada. But what is difficult is it's very difficult for Albertans to imagine an Alberta beyond oil. So yes, energy transition will happen, but when is kind of a question mark.
How do you go about bridging that conversation then in Alberta?
Well, the degree to which people in Alberta support an energy transition depends a lot on their perception of how well they or their family will thrive, you know, which is maybe not surprising. It's like, if I think that I'm going to thrive, then I'm supportive of a transition. If I don't think that's the case, then I double down on my beliefs in the future of oil and gas, and I tend to become more oppositional to an oil and gas transition. So I think diversification is common ground for people. So Albertans are tired of a boom and bust economy. Yeah, it's great when it's really, really good, but it really sucks when it's, you know, it's really bad. And very few people, I think, at this point wouldn't have some sort of connection with someone who has lost their job or has struggled through those downturns. So common ground is definitely around the need for diversification, the need to get out of boom and bust, and the opportunities related to kind of other types of sectors. Now, that's not to say start a conversation about diversification, but yeah, let's talk about tech, let's talk about film, let's talk about, you know, healthcare research that would allow us to have a good quality of life. And one last point, when we were in focus groups, you know, we were talking to a couple groups of moms and we asked them, you know, would you recommend your children go into jobs in oil and gas? And across the board, they universally said no. And so I, at the same time, they talked a lot about how their children don't see a future here necessarily in Alberta because of the political culture or because of the economic opportunities. Or so I think that for some people, safe ground is really a talking about the need to build opportunities that provide more stability, that allow us to live here and have a good quality of life and, you know, keep our families together and our chickens, you know, close to the nest.
Of course, that resonates with us coming from an organization advocating for generational fairness. That I want to hear more about that. I'm surprised why the moms worry about their kids being in oil and gas and why they worry they don't have a future in Alberta. What do they feel is driving them away?
Yeah, well, firsthand in the focus groups that we were doing, on the one hand, people don't see a future in oil and gas. You know, it will inevitably, you know, transition. But on the other hand, it's hard to see in Alberta beyond oil. So for us, it's like interesting. Somewhere in there is a timeline that we're all collectively holding around transition. It is not exactly short enough for the people who currently work there, but it's not long enough for people's children to have an entire career. So somewhere in there is a sense that the industry won't be the kind of economic engine that it is or has been. The other pieces that kind of came up in those conversations were around political culture. And so it would be helpful to mention this great piece of work that came out of the University of Alberta. And there's a researcher there called Dr. Jared Wesley. And he took a look at how do Albertans see themselves? And so he did this interesting exercise. He asked people to draw your typical Albertan. And by and large, for the most part, people drew, you know, either an oil rig worker or a farmer, rancher kind of person, predominantly white, predominantly male, predominantly conservative. And when you lay that side by side to where are we, it's very, very different. That is not who we are, you know. And so very few people, less than 15%, fit that stereotype. The majority of Albertans sit either in the center or left of center. And with that, they hold kind of progressive environmental values. But that stereotype kind of limits our public imagination of who we are and what is politically possible and what's the kind of policy that, you know, we can have here. So I think that's really important when we're thinking about, you know, first and foremost, let's just make those people more visible, not only to the rest of Canada, but to ourselves, to kind of increase this sense of belief and possibility that, yeah, we can live in a place that aligns with and supports, you know, the kind of vision I have for the place where I want to live. So I think that's really important. The other thing I would say, you know, climate's like super polarized here, still is. There are very well-funded groups who have worked very hard to make it toxic. But that's not to say that climate doesn't connect to everything we care about. So we can have a conversation about anything, really, and it can be a climate change conversation. So whether that's about affordability or if that's about future job opportunities or health or inflation or protection of nature, or, you know, there's lots of different kind of entry points into those conversations. But I think in Alberta, perhaps more so than in other places, who is having the conversation really, really, really matters. When you ask people unprompted, like, who's trusted?
Tell us.
Doctors are trusted, healthcare professionals are trusted, academics are trusted,
woohoo,
scientists are trusted, small business leaders are trusted. And so given how much effort is put into kind of polarizing this conversation, who is leading the conversation is really, really important.
It's so interesting how much you've talked about these points of common ground where it's easier to talk to people. But something we struggle with a lot is at some point you got to get to the hard truth. And I think a recent example for us is pollution pricing is a cornerstone of our climate policy solutions, but not all Canadians are on board with it. But at the same time, we need to talk about it. How do you talk in a way that works and you can still find those points of agreement?
Yeah, well, I wish I had a nice, neat answer for you. You know, the pollster that we worked with, Janet Brown, likes to say that the big difference for Albertans is that they don't like to pay taxes. And I think it's kind of true. So anything that's talking about a tax is going to be difficult. I mean, I think it has to do with we have spent a lot of time talking about how the mechanism works and not what it does, and certainly not the benefits that people will see out of it. And I, you know, talk about this stuff all day, every day, and it still is kind of hard for me to believe, like, you're going to take tax from me, but then I get it all back? Like, I don't understand how that works, right? It doesn't make sense. And so I think that it would be really helpful to start talking about what is the carbon tax revenues doing? How has it been invested? What are the kinds of results that we're seeing? And make it practical and tangible and something that people can see in our daily lives. So I think if we can start to point to, here's what it does, and this is how it benefits you, something specific to talk about, rather than it just being about this kind of theoretical disagreement on who gets to tax me and then gets to decide what to do with my money, which is kind of where it gets sticky.
That's interesting. When you started your answer saying, like, oh, you know, so much of the talk about pricing pollution and gets sucked into the weeds about this sort of tax conversation, you lose people. But I wonder a little bit about that, Amber, at this moment, because I think at the heart of the pricing pollution conversation in this country and across the planet, it is like, is pollution free or not, or is pollution harmful? And if pollution's harmful, then, you know, people should take responsibility for the harm that they're causing and, you know, admittedly, you know, pay a contribution for that. So I partly wonder about, like, is that conversation, that values conversation, that pollution isn't free, that we should take responsibility for our actions, does that not hold as much in Alberta? And what motivates the question I have right now is that, you know, we've been looking very carefully, not only at the policy announcements being put out by the parties, but just the general discourse around the election in Alberta right now. And for listeners who aren't paying as much attention, where Alberta really is on fire. But there is a discomfort, I think, in Alberta about talking about the extreme weather and the harm that that's causing so many people, thousands of people evacuating and whatnot, loss of livestock, homes, etc. But I don't see an obvious conversation then emerging in the election right now and like, well, this relates to the amount of carbon that we're emitting and how that's causing climate change and the tools available to us to try and fend off this harm. So here's my last long-winded way of I think I figured out my question while I was talking to you. Never great for a podcast. You know, I'm witnessing in Alberta people doing many, many lovely things for one another. Like, you're out of your home, come into mine. Let me feed you. Let me give you clothing. Let me provide you some shelter. I'm going to be an amazing neighbor in the middle of this disaster. That takes so much more effort from community members than it would to do some of the much more modest things to try and prevent or reduce extreme weather from causing as many fires or as floods as it's doing. How come that connection isn't being made in the middle of an election or more generally?
I'm not sure where to start, Paul. You know, to what degree people make a connection between extreme weather, pollution, carbon tax, government solutions, etc. I think there's so many steps between all of those pieces. I think for people who have very limited bandwidth, whose priorities are around health and their health care, and who we're not spending more than 30 minutes a year thinking about this, of which we know there's more than half of the population, you know, fall within that. I think these kind of complicated policy conversations are just not, it's too many steps for a lot of people. So I think that the other piece that's important is just trust, right? So it's like, even if I understand the relationship between taxing pollution, do I trust the government to say what it's going to do with my taxes is a question mark, I think, for a lot of people. So I think, yes, perhaps the kind of quickest answer to this is, you know, the certainty from economists for this kind of tool. I think the values piece around pollution is bad and we need to make polluters pay, That framing works. It does work. I guess what I'm just saying is that it kind of falls down when you get into the weeds, right? When you get into the weeds of what political party are you talking about? What solution are you specifically talking about? You know, and then the kind of persistent and relentless and insidious misinformation that is infused into the conversation as well. So what I'm suggesting is like, sidestep that and just start talking to people about things that they in their own personal experience can see, can trust, can have a sense that this is going to benefit me and my community and the people I love. Because a lot of this gets sidelined by, in Alberta anyhow, it's like, well, it's just not practical. It's all those progressives and that ideological stuff and et cetera. And so I think we need to just get more real with people. Even as the world burns, we can't, there's no shortcut, unfortunately. That's what I think. And I'd be happy, I'm sure that listeners or other people will say other things, but...
So given the so many steps between talking about policy levers like pricing pollution and then seeing how that relates to extreme weather, it clearly isn't good politics right now. You don't have either of the leading parties really making any effort to say, wow, we're really frightened right now about the fires that are burning down towns and causing so much damage and smoking out now Calgary, where we're meeting with you today. But I worry, you know, you said like, there's a lack of trust amongst residents of Alberta, and we see this across the country, a lack of trust in government to lead effectively. And this seems to be then a problem to fix a lot of broken systems, whether it's like housing unaffordability, whether it is, you know, climate change. But we can only do those things through public policy change. We can only do them through government. And so individuals can't solve big systemic problems alone. We have to do it through our activities as communities and cities and governments, the way that we do that.
Yeah. And I guess I believe that if we can tell stories where things worked and where they are working and then draw connections to people's lives, that that helps to address the kind of defensiveness that we're all collectively holding around we're going to hell in a handbasket. Governments are not stepping up and acting quickly enough to protect us and have our best interests in mind. And so that's where you kind of get apathy. If it doesn't feel like it's going to make a difference, then why bother? But if we can tell stories where it has made a difference, this has been effective, I think that those nuggets help to break through the defensiveness that we have and help us open up with a sense of trust. And this falling trust is something that is happening.
Jurisdictions like around the world.
Problem, yeah. Right? Yeah. But to go back to that point around, well, then what is the role of people who we do trust in helping to act as translators between what governments or public systems can do for us? You know, what is the role of doctors to help educate us around, like, and this is what this means, and this is how it's going to impact your daily life, right? I think that if we can have those people that still have a certain amount of trust within the public act as translators, that will go a long way, provided that they're talking about things that people care about, right? It's very hard to care about a carbon tax, right? But I would be very happy to talk about a retrofit program that makes my home more comfortable in the winter time or in the summer, or a training program or a new, you know, innovation to bring new industries into Calgary, whatever that might be. I care a lot about my children being able to live in this place. Talk to me about that. A carbon tax. That's hard.
You just brought up something that I want to ask you about, because of course you're a mom, and I'm curious what generational fairness means to you as a mom and climate communicator.
Yeah, I love that question. I'm sure that I could overthink this a lot, but
we overthink generational fairness all the time, so join the club.
You know, but what I think about is, like, if you made the mess, help clean it up. You know, that's what I think about when I think about generational.
If you made the mess, help clean it up.
Yeah. You know, like, they didn't make this mess. They should not have to clean it up. They're already going to be faced with so much change. And so I think that it really comes down to us cleaning up the mess before they are expected to take the reins. And boy, do we talk a lot about cleaning up your mess in my house. So, mom, that's like a really well-worn track.
So then you need to look in the mirror. Hey, we have to provide that mirror.
Yeah. I would even go up one step further.
Please.
And we still live in this, I don't want to call it a fantasy. That might be a bit harsh. But we still live in this time when we think climate change is change. Like, it could change back. We could just put enough solar panels on something and get back, you know, where we were. And I think it needs to be done with care. And I think it needs to be done with a lot of empathy. And I think as moms and grandmothers and as parents, we need to get real about the fact that we are never ever going back, not in our generation or our children's or their children. We are locked in for centuries of this. And so I think that that will help when we're faced with decisions, be it on cost or investment or priorities, that will help us make choices that are more reflective of where we're at. And I believe that women and parents and mothers have a very big capacity to have that kind of conversation. That said, research would show that men in Alberta are a bit more real about, you know, the inevitability of the transition than other demographics. And I guess let's not stop there. We kind of need to get real, connected to like, these are the things that I love. And that kind of love is what is going to like pull us through the hard conversation and into the motivation to do something differently.
Well, we have a lot of conversations on this podcast about talking about love or being angry. And so it's interesting to see that we've come back to this love theme right now. If I have time, Megan, can I have one more follow-up? May I?
I want to follow up.
Okay, you have the follow-up. Go ahead, follow up. Yes, your turn.
Back in Texas, there's all these wonderful nature preserves, like that painting behind you. And I remember taking my kids to one that I hadn't been to since one of the worst wildfires in Texas. And so my memory of it was this incredible mountain covered in aspen and pine trees. And I just had this vision of what my family's experience is going to be there. And we got there and it was just like gone. And that's what my kids saw. And that's all they'll never know. And that's horrifying to me. Like, what's real now, so much has already been lost. And then I just get depressed. And yeah. So what do you do with those feelings? Do you have those too?
Well, Megan, we would have had a nice big cry probably about 5 hours ago when I woke up. Can I tell you one little story about this painting?
Please. Yes.
So I got this painting while I was doing a project interviewing off-highway vehicle users in southern Alberta. And so there was a big push to protect a big piece of land for grizzly bear habitat. And so my job was, as I went and I did a whole bunch of kind of long interviews with these dudes who were off-highway vehicle users. And I think what I took away from that is that their connection to that land had everything to do with family and love and the fact that their family or father or grandfather had taken them to that place and they wanted to take their children to that place. How they connected with the land was that they got there, you know, with these ATVs and quads and things like that. That didn't mean that their connection to the land was any different than the others who were backpacking and, you know, leave no trace and, you know, et cetera. The way that they did it was different, but why they did it and what it meant to them when they got there was really the same. And they equated not being able to go to those places with the same grief that you've just explained. It's like it's lost, you know, it's gone to them. So, you know, I don't have an answer to that really, other than the more we can connect to those special places and spend time together. Maybe not in the midst of a, you know, forest fire, but out of a forest fire comes new growth, right? Comes a rebirth of other things. Nature can be as amazing even after a forest fire as it is, you know, in full bloom. There's still things that are happening there. It is not void. And for children, that rebirth may be as a powerful a story that we need right now, that we can recover, that we, you know, that there is still life, I think is very important for to carry them through the amount of change that they're going to have to face and figure out, right? Nature's resilient. That is a message that all of us need to hear. it will be different. It will not be the way that we see it now. But there will still be something there.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm back.
All right. Thanks for coming back, Angie.
And I love that you guys did all the heavy lifting with the interview, and I just get to pop in at the end, and we can have a little chit-chat huddle about how it all went.
Woo! You know, it is hard to talk about climate change. Still work to inroads to make there. And so towards the end, there was this theme of like, oh, if you made the mess, help clean it up.
Clean it up, yeah.
And I started thinking afterwards, like, how much work are we still needing to do to convince people that they help make the mess? Really, there's so much work that needs to be done between, okay, pricing pollution and how that relates to extreme weather. But, you know, she's like, there's 6 points in between. I would have thought for sure Amber was going to tell us, you know, the majority of Canadians recognize we've contributed to making the mess. I'm not sure that's what I took away from her. And if we don't have it on that one, that issue, if it's not safe enough to talk about the connection between climate change and the province being on fire in the middle of an election, because that just is such bad politics,
then I do get
very nervous.
Yeah, I totally agree. You want the campaign promise, because then they are compelled to put money behind it. If it's all behind the scenes, like, I think that the heavy work must happen between elections, but the public-facing work has to happen at election time. It just feels like when I think about like healthcare and whether wholeheartedly or reluctantly government actually invests resources in a certain thing, the first thing that they are looking at is their campaign promise. So,
absolutely. I think what's so discouraging a little bit about what Amber said, though, is that, you know, we can't blame political parties if they don't think they're going to win an election by raising it. That's not a political party problem. That is a population problem. That is a societal problem, that we haven't created the political cover for it to be safe to draw a connection between climate change and our province being on fire during an election moment. And I guess this also goes to who we think we are and who we actually are. And with such a beautiful answer, Megan was saying, you know, we're finding conversations are a bit different in Alberta, and why might that be? But Amber's answer, like, you know, not really. Actually, Albertans are like the rest of Canadians on this, and sometimes the rest of Canada can be a bit judgy about Alberta. But actually, we ought to then turn that judgment around and look in the mirror. You know, hard truth, we're actually very similar.
Yeah. What she got me thinking about was, who do we think we are? We think we're good people. We think we want to take care of each other. We think we want to take care of our families. And who are we actually in terms of our behaviors? So the contrast I was making in my head was, we think we are X, but we're actually Y. And we should really look at ourselves in the mirror and think about that. I'm not sure where that gets us.
Well, that's the difference. You know, I guess that is some of the hard truth. That's the whole reason why our podcast is branded this way is... Mm-hmm. Is there a mismatch between the stories that we tell about ourselves being, you know, the good, caring, nurturing neighbors and family members and parents and kids, and by comparison with then, you know, the day-to-day actions or the day-to-day decisions we reinforce in the world of politics, which then create these really significant tensions?
Yeah.
That is the hard truth. And I'm a huge Tom King fan. Shout out to Tom King. Wish he was a listener. and I love his book, The Truth About Stories. The Truth About Stories, that's all we are. And I think that Amber was helping to unpack that a bit in both a hopeful and discouraging kind of way. Hopeful that there are ways to motivate one another to care about these issues that are going to matter for protecting us from the worst of climate change. I guess that was her reason. Like, you know, it's partly about values, but make it concrete for people about how this is going to improve their daily lives. Or like, you know, what's actually going to change for them? I just think, you know, what do we do at a systems level when actually some of the systems things they're not just at your back door in your neighborhood, they're happening in a more pervasive kind of way throughout our communities and province and country. And those things matter.
Yeah.
Like the price signal on pricing pollution. It's such an important part of the solution. And yet it's hard to make that concrete in the way that Amber was describing.
Yeah, I was trying to think about that too, just because I think she was saying, make the benefits to me and my family tangible. But a lot of the policy changes are where we see the results years down the road, right? So I think that's why we constantly get the same strategy from government, which is, let's cut you a new check this year. let's give you $400 back into your pocket as if that's going to do anything. It's tangible and you can make an announcement about it, but is it actually better preparing our kids for the future? Is it actually helping me avoid disease? Is it, you know, is it doing all those things? No, probably not. But as a population, if what we demand is tangible, but what we need is something more intangible, like, I just don't know how to reconcile those two things. We can't expect a meaningful, tangible change necessarily. Like, the kinds of changes that we are hoping for are very complex.
Yeah, that's such a clever observation. And then bringing it back to then the election, you know, you might have expected like the competition between two parties to be capturing different camps on the issue of climate change. Like they would, each leader would be part of a different bubble. But clearly, you know, when it comes to the climate change as a political issue, there's a very large bubble, which is that doesn't want to see the connection between the province on fire and the pollution we're putting out there, mm-hmm. or the way we're organizing our economies, or getting ourselves, you know, to work, or driving our kids to various important, you know, sports and so on. It's very, very big. And by contrast, the bubble, I guess, that wakes up, you know, is thinking each day about those issues is much more modest. And then I'm not sure, what does that mean? But I can imagine there are some listeners out there who are like, no, BS, all I ever hear about is climate change, climate change, climate change. You know, we talk about it all the time. So what's the disconnect in this moment of politics? And when's the truth about who we are and who we want to be and who we need to become? Because I think the political moment has got to be a mirror to all of us. What do we really find appealing and what's going to shape who we vote for?
I think, Paul, you had mentioned that if now is not the time where climate change can become a mainstream issue and maybe even an election issue that we talk about, because the province is burning down in May and has been burning every summer, at least for the last few summers. So like the effects of it are literally in our faces and pushing people out of their homes. Like if it's not now, then when? And there was something that in the interview that struck me about how the current challenges that a family faces in terms of oil and gas. So she was focusing, I think, on oil and gas industry, is like, there is an acceptance that that is not going to be the long-term driver of the economy for that province anymore, but that there has been no vision offered for the alternative. And so there is a bit of a paralysis. This, I don't know if she said the word paralysis, but what the sense that I got was that people just sort of continue with the status quo. They know that what is behind them is actually behind them, but there's no really positive vision about where to go. That, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I think in the context of the Alberta election, if you look at both of the main party platforms, they talk about economic diversification all over the place. Mm-hmm. That definitely has become sort of accepted norm no matter who's running for office. So that maybe it's not painting as eloquent and inviting a beach for people to go to through this depiction of what economic diversification looks like. Maybe that's still too technical, but I wonder about the degree to which, though, people are believing that there's the win-win, or is it still that, you know, if we only give the win-win and we don't have the hard conversation, like the transition is, you know, going to be bumpy and sometimes bumpy for other people. And we do have a large conversation about just transition for our economy as we move from a fossil fuel intensive to something that is relying more on renewables. But the just transition language clearly hasn't resonated at a population level in Alberta yet, and sometimes can be actually politicized, you know, the just transition of that particular government or that particular woke thinking. And so I wonder if the, you know, those working hard on the activities around just transition maybe need to take up your call to like paint this more positive vision of like the beach we're going to, why it's better, you know, but maybe in language that is more appealing to a kind of centrist population that Amber described as being who the Alberta population is.
Yeah.
I think that's a great place to end.
Well, friends, this was really fun. I'm glad we're back in the saddle. Oh my God, I'm going to start singing. Oh, back in the saddle again. Where a friend is a friend. Where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again.
All right.
This is the highlight of my work day. Now I have to go back to work.
Thanks for joining us. You can learn more about Jen the Squeeze and check out our Alberta Voters Guide at jensqueeze.ca.